During the chanting, I remembered I'd forgotten to turn my ringer off, and I couldn't do the button with just one hand. But I actually did it. I had this moment of, oh my God, what if it rings? But then it was like, it's just a gong anyway. Let's plow through a bit more of the Bhagavad Gita, and then we'll chant some more. I'm determined to get to the end of this chapter tonight. This desire, my desire that I'm very attached to.
I like what you said, that little quote.
Oh, yes. Isn't that lovely?
What was it?
In the email that you never opened.
I can remember right on.
But it's right here. It's the very first one. Though the unwise cling to their actions, watching for results, the wise are free of attachments and act for the well-being of the whole world.
And what for the whole being of the whole world?
Though the unwise cling to their actions, watching for results, the wise are free of attachments and act for the well-being of the whole world. I like that one so much. So I think it's... I mean, there it is. I think I was it in the email or in the blog? I think on the blog I said a little bit more about this, that if you want a standard for right action, here it is. Like anything that we do, we can check in with ourselves. Am I clinging to action? Am I watching for results? If so, I'm in the unwise. If my action is free of attachment and for the well-being of the whole world, then I'm good to go. Right now, so here we are in this insane time in this country where one side absolutely believes one thing is true and the other side absolutely believes something else is true. And it's almost like some weird science fiction story where there's these two different realities or existing parallel to each other in the same place but somehow in different dimensions, and there's no connect, and yet we're all here on the same planet together. And some of the big political questions of the day, you know, I wonder, like any issue that I feel very strongly about, the opposite side will make just as strong a case for themselves as I'll make on their side as I'll make on my side. And I suppose even this can be bent. I suppose what one considers as the well-being of the world, someone else may not. But I think it's about the best definition we're going to get. And it continues. The wise man, I love this one also, the wise man does not unsettle the minds of the ignorant. Quietly acting in the spirit of yoga, he inspires them to do the same. If you put those two together, it's really becoming a very helpful teaching. The wise man does not unsettle the minds of the ignorant. Quietly acting in the spirit of yoga, he inspires them to do the same. And remember, by ignorant, it just means someone who has not yet realized their true nature. Right? So if we put them together, though the unwise cling to their actions, watching for results, the wise are free of attachments and act for the well-being of the whole world. The wise man does not unsettle the minds of the ignorant. We could leave off ignorant. The wise man does not unsettle the minds of others, creating all kinds of agitation and worry and disturbance. Quietly, acting in the spirit of yoga, he simply inspires the other to act that way as well. It's very, very profound. Actions are really performed by the working of the three gunas, but a man deluded by the eye sense imagines, I am the doer. This is the verse I've been resisting for now. This is why I haven't gotten to this for the last few weeks. So, the philosophy behind the three gunas gets unpacked and explained in different ways depending on which school you're in. And I can't begin to get caught up in all that hair splitting. So I'm just going to give you the very simple way that I best understand the gunas. And one thing that I like very much, let's keep this verse again. Actions are really performed by the working of the three gunas. But a man deluded by the eye sense imagines, I am the doer. What I love about this verse is it basically removes free will. It basically removes the idea that we're actually responsible for anything that we do, which doesn't get us off the hook and allow us to not take responsibility for every time we make a mess of things. But it does have us pull back and say that I, that attaches us to all kinds of ideas is perhaps not as powerful as it likes to believe it is. And so that notion of I am not the doer, that's a very yogic notion. And it's encouraging us to just sit back and really watch the play and allow that upsurge of consciousness that gets called the self. And you know, that's what's really. That's the actor. And the eye is just identifying with whatever catches its fancy. Yeah? So the gunas, it's interesting. I like to think of the gunas as three veils that come down and distort our experience of life. To me, we experience life really through the senses. And, I mean, there are other systems that will spin this differently, but you just play with this way of looking at them. If you think of pure consciousness, it's just pure consciousness. It's the presence that pervades everything that we do, that we are, all of our action. And when we're merged with just that, everything just flows as it's meant to be in the most natural way, because we're not interfering with that natural ebb and flow of life. The three gunas, they're called sattva, rajas, and tamas. And the sattva guna is like a very clear veil. So when we perceive through sattva guna, we're still experiencing life in a clear way. And they'll add on to this. It's truth, it's beauty, it's clarity, it's luminosity, it's all the things that we think of as beneficial or positive. Rajas gunas is very active, fiery, energetic. And the tamas guna is very still. These often get valued. So, and this is one reason I stay away from this whole body of teaching. Sattva is considered good, tamas is considered bad, rajas is sort of in the middle, but rajas they don't really like either because it's too active and too energized, and it's like to be sattvic is the way to go. But the thing about when we're in a very sattvic state, we can become attached to that also. You know, it's like lovely to feel good and feel light. And then we want that all the time. So then when we're in a tamasic state, we're just like, oh, what's wrong with me? And to me, you know, tamas, it's stillness. It gets this bad rap. It's inert. It's heavy. It's of the earth. But it's stillness. And you know, the rajas guna also, you know, it gets a really bad rap. Some of it's this is why people, you know, very like orthodox yogis don't eat onions and garlic because it's too stimulating. Right. God forbid you should be stimulated. But no, It's good to be stimulated. We just don't want to be driven crazy by stimulation. You know, we don't want to be bogged down in tamas, but we want to be still. And so, like everything else, it's about balance. And the gunas, when we're in alignment, the gunas are balancing each other out inside of us. We easily get out of alignment, but that's another conversation. So, but that's what is being articulated here. And there's actually a whole chapter later on that who knows if we'll ever get to it, on the gunas. And I think in the context of this point of the Gita, or this part of the Gita, in a way we can see how the gunas working with the sense of I, this is what creates the storyline. This is what creates the narrative. Right? I'm a good person, I'm a bad person, I'm too this, I'm too that, I had a bad day in the studio. All the story, that's all in this system, that's all coming from the gunas. Actions are really performed by the working of the three gunas, but a man deluded by the I sense imagines I am the doer. So, you know, if you're having a bad day, you're just having a bad day. But if one of the gunas gets in and starts influencing how you perceive yourself, it's, oh my God, I'm never going to get out of this rut. But see, it wasn't us. It's just a guna plopping in to our experience. The wise man knows that when objects act on the senses, it is merely the gunas acting on the gunas. Thus, he is unattached. The wise man knows that when objects, it's so technical, when objects act on the senses, it is merely the gunas acting on the gunas, thus he is unattached. So for instance, I'm walking along, it's a beautiful day, so the objects around me, the beautiful trees and flowers, the daffodils, the forsythia are blooming, the flowering, so there's all this beauty. So that's like sattva guna, and it acts on me, and it puts me in a good mood. But then I'm going to get attached to that good mood. So then when it's raining and cold, then those are going to be acting on me, and then I'm going to get in a bad mood. The wise man knows that when objects act on the senses, it is merely the gunas acting on the gunas. Thus, he is unattached. Deluded by the gunas, men grow attached to the gunas' actions. The insightful should not disturb the minds of these foolish men. Well, I don't know about that, but anyway. Performing all actions for my sake, remember this is Krishna talking, Krishna's personifying the inner self. Performing all actions for my sake, desireless, absorbed in the self, indifferent to I and mine, let go, and now remember he's talking to Arjuna who's having a breakdown before the battle, let go of your grief and fight. Performing all actions for my sake, desireless, absorbed in the self, indifferent to I and mine, let go of your grief and fight. But you know, that's no different than, you know, if somebody comes to me for a session and they're all caught up in some whatever, and I say, it's a story. Will you relax? Just do your life. Everything is fine. You're so caught up in drama. I'll be a drama queen. That's really what this chapter verse is saying. That's really what this verse is saying. Don't be a drama queen. Just do your work. Do whatever is arising for you now without attachment, without being flung around by all this emotional stuff. Just be in your life as you are, and everything will happen as it needs to happen. That's what performing all actions for my sake is. Desireless, absorbed in the self. That's what it is. Men who constantly practice this teaching, Arjuna, who trust it with all their hearts, are freed from the bondage of action. Men who constantly practice this teaching, Arjuna, who trust it with all their heart, are freed from the bondage of actions. But those who mistrustful, half-hearted, fail to practice my teacher, wander in the darkness, lost. Oh, come on, that gets a little heavy. Let's just skip that one. Even the wise, I don't like it when it lays these trips. You know, it's just like, we don't need this. Even the wise man acts in accordance with his inner nature. All beings follow their nature. What good can repression do? That's a good one. I like that one a lot. Even the wise man acts in accordance with his inner nature. All beings follow their nature. What good can repression do? And what is that saying? We have to allow ourselves to be what we are. And that's not easy, because we're very complex and we're very large, and we're often asked to squeeze ourselves into very small containers. And the challenge really is being the hugeness that we are and moving through a world that is designed to make us contract to fit and being free of that. And here's that one from last week or 2 weeks ago. It is better to do your own duty badly than to perfectly do another's. You are safe from harm when you do what you should be doing. You are safe from harm when you do what you should be doing. You know, and the question, of course, arises, well, how do I know what I should be doing? And this is where the only answer I've ever felt to that question is we have to keep reaching in inside of us. And we feel truth when we're in it. And when we're going against what we are, we know, even if just 1% of our awareness is picking it up, we know. And even though we sometimes only realize later, oops, I was going against myself, wasn't I? Well, then we can chalk that up as a lesson and apply it as we move forward. I mean, I think that's the other very hopeful message here, which is that it's always a work in progress. It's always a work in process, this life. And we're going to fall down and make 4 million zillion mistakes. And maybe we're never even going to get it right. But we're going to keep working to hear that sense of, yes, that sense of correct, that sense of truth, that sense of alignment. I don't even know a word that really embodies the experience, but we know it when we're in it. And when we're in it, no matter how difficult the outer circumstances may be, we are fine. And that's what that Tara mantra really is. We are fine. So then Arjuna says, what is it that drives a man to evil action, Krishna, even against his will, as if some force made him do it? And Krishna says, that force is desire. It is anger, arising from the guna called rajas, deadly and all-devouring. That is the enemy here. That force is desire. It is anger arising from the guna called rajas, deadly and all-devouring. That is the enemy here. And as I've said before about this particular teaching, I think it's really attachment. I don't have a problem with desire. I don't have a problem with anger. I don't have a problem with rajas. I don't have a problem with anything arising inside of us or arising around us. I think the problem is attachment. I think the problem is clinging and making stories about. I think, in fact, desire can be great. When we use desire, when we really learn how to work with desire to merge with our own divinity, how great is that? It's but when we allow desire to just pull us down these roads that in the end are going to open up into nothing but a lot of suffering, that's when we're That's what this text is talking about here. That forces desire is anger arising from the guna called rajas, deadly and all devouring, that is the enemy here. But we could say that forces attachment. That forces attachment. As a fire is obscured by smoke, as a mirror is covered by dust, as a fetus is wrapped in its membrane, so wisdom is obscured by desire. And again, we could substitute desire with attachment to desire. Wisdom, and it's true, wisdom is obscured by the attachment to desire. And don't get me wrong, I mean, desire is very tricky. I was thinking about it on the way over. Desire is really tricky. It's very powerful. And when the ego grabs hold of it, that sense of I grabs hold of it, it can create havoc in our life, in our being. And letting go of the attachment to desire, that's hard, because desire is very seductive. It's very sexy. So here I disagree. This is not I'm out of a tantric tradition. This is not from that tradition. It's a little more duality than I'm comfortable with. Wisdom is destroyed, Arjuna, by the constant enemy of the West. See, I don't think wisdom is ever really destroyed. I think it gets covered over. Which flaring up as desire blazes with insatiable flames. So yeah, let's move on. But here, now this is going to be appropriate for us again. Desire dwells in the senses, the mind, and the understanding. In all these, it obscures wisdom and perplexes the embodied self. Well, again, I don't think the self ever gets perplexed. But still, you can read between the lines and get what this text is trying to tell us. Desire, aka attachment, dwells in the senses, the mind, and the understanding. In all these, it obscures wisdom. It obscures our experience of the self. It obscures the experience of our infinite amazingness. Therefore, you must first control your senses, Arjuna. Yeah, I mean, that's a little heavy-handed. Then destroy this evil that prevents you from ever knowing the truth. No. And it's not even so much control the senses. We're never going to control the senses. That's what they do. They just love to experience the world. Show the eyes something beautiful. Play the ears something beautiful. Give the mouth something delicious to taste. Let the touch feel something silky and wonderful. Who did I leave out? Smell? Did I get smell? Mm-hmm. A wonderful aroma. For me, I'm talking now from a tantric sense. It's like, that's fabulous. You know, the world is amazing. It's just so incredible. It's also horrible and sickening and repulsive and filled with wonder and glory and luminosity and beauty. And there's nothing wrong with the senses. What we need to work on is the tendency of the ego, otherwise known as the I-maker, otherwise known as just that sense of I am the, that tendency to appropriate whatever it's attracted to, or repulsed by for that matter, and then cling to it and think it's going to be forever. That's the problem. There's no other problem. That's the problem. And here I like what he says. Men say that the senses are strong, but the mind is stronger than the senses. This is true. The understanding is stronger than the mind. This is true. And strongest is the self. And it's true. And that again, even with all the little guilt trips this text lays on us, it's very helpful. Because it's saying, don't worry about it. You've got the self. Everybody has a self. Just keep plugging into that self, and that's stronger than your understanding. And your understanding is stronger than your mind. And your mind, in the end, is stronger than your senses. So relax. It's all good. It's all good. Knowing the self, sustaining the self by the self. Arjuna, now we're going to get heavy-handed again. Kill the difficult-to-conquer enemy called desire. We don't have to kill the difficult-to-conquer enemy. In fact, we need to make friends with the difficult-to-conquer enemy desire. And we make friends with that difficult to conquer enemy, desire, by staring it into its face and saying, okay, I see you, I want to work with you. Let's work together to make it all better. Yeah? So, hallelujah, we've gotten to the end of chapter 3. The Bhagavad Gita scholars will be very critical of everything I've said this evening. But let it percolate around inside of you. See what your own understanding, which is stronger than your mind, and a servant to the self. See what that does with all these lovely verses. Let it live inside of you.